This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with journalist and author Andrew Revkin. He created and writes for the Dot Earth blog of the New York Times. I spoke with him on November 28, 2012, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. He spoke to us from his home in New York. This interview is included in our show about Teilhard de Chardin. Download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org.
Is it going to be possible to turn off your computer?
Hello?
I could. Okay. You can hear them.
I can hear everything.
Okay, hold on.
Hello?
I hear all of these.
Hello?
Hi, it's Krista Tippett.
How are you?
I'm glad we made this happen.
I know, I'm sorry about it. I had some unexpected things happen.
But that was really good. Yeah, well, I get that with picking children up. I have a hockey-playing son.
It's the backup disc.
And are we making this work with a non-landline? I think this may
we
be
are.
A first.
Yeah, no, I'm actually on. I actually found a hardwired. I forgot we have a fax machine.
Oh.
And that I haven't used in a while, so I'm all set.
Okay. Well, it's always good to push our edges.
Yep.
So I feel like the minute I get into reading you in that kind of sustained way, there are so many things I'd like to talk about. So maybe there's another conversation in our future. But what I want to do today is, because I know this, I really appreciate you fitting this in. So I really want to just completely focus in on the noosphere and Teilhard and just really do this in 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. All right. And then we can save other interesting things for some other time. So are we ready, Chris? Okay. All right. So tell me, first of all, how did you discover Teilhard de Chardin? And I'm curious if you first discovered the spiritual Teilhard or the scientific Teilhard.
Well, for me, it actually started with Vladimir Vernadsky, who was a Russian geochemist who intersected with Teilhard and others intellectually in the early 20th century around this idea that humans were becoming... Well, actually, Vernadsky had... He was the first scientist who really sort of said we were becoming a global geological force. The human species already to him in the early part of the 20th century was becoming a part of the geosphere, not just the biosphere. Mm-hmm. And then he had articulated aspects of this idea of a growing noosphere. And Teilhard and he and others started articulating it in new ways. So I was writing about the whole issue of the human the growing impact of humans on the planetary system in a biogeophysical way. And then I backed into Teilhard, although then I realized he intersected with other stuff that I'd been reading and writing about from decades earlier, just even before I was a journalist. The work of René Dubos, the work of Thomas Berry. And so it all was kind of a...
That he was kind of resonant, that those were kindred ideas out there.
Yeah, for sure. But for me, it really started with Vernadsky. And then when I started backtracking on that whole question of how this Russian geochemist had come to think of us as evolving a growing kind of planet of the mind, then I stumbled into Teilhard, which
Jesuit
was kind of fun.
Jesuit priest, paleontologist.
Yeah, right. But of course, then I learned that, you know, he had his scientific background. And,
yeah.
And it was just so wonderful. So many of these characters I've ended up focusing on are at the intersection of spiritual and scientific. It's really interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so interesting to me because, well, first of all, I didn't know you studied biology. I didn't realize you went to Brown. I went to Brown. I graduated in 83.
Ah.
Yeah. So you studied biology and then you became a journalist. And, I mean, here you are with this very 21st century life. You've been writing about the environment and climate change, looks to me like nearly three decades. So, I mean, you have a very different life and a very different perspective on life from this Jesuit paleontologist, but you know, when I see things you say, like we are slowly enveloping the world in our own intelligence, and it's exactly the kind of thing that Teilhard de Chardin was saying from such a different vantage point, you know, 100 years ago.
Well, and then as I dug in even more, I did a piece a few years ago on Dot Earth on the path tracing this back through. Actually, Vaclav Havel.
Oh, right, right.
Mm-hmm. And then back to Darwin. Darwin's less famous book, not The Origin of Species, oh my God, I'm blanking on it right now. Anyway, he talked about the fact that we were overcoming
the
our
descent
tribal
of man
nature.
Sorry. The Descent of Man?
Yeah. In The Descent of Man, mm-hmm. in 1871, Darwin wrote a passage about how we were fundamentally tribal, but that the more that humans were interrelating with each other, the more, you know, through commerce, through trade, the more our sense of tribe would expand. And then he said, only an artificial barrier stands, and he used that phrase, before we will become essentially one tribe, a global kind of, not just intelligence, but a global community. And now, of course, we're breaching that artificial barrier with technology.
And, you know, when I see you out there talking, I was watching something, a talk you gave at Cooper Hewitt. You know, you talk about this also in evolutionary terms. I mean, you say things like, you know, we have been in puberty as a species. Mm-hmm. And science is saying to us, you have to grow up. And yet it's tricky, isn't it? Because this technology that maybe somebody like Teilhard or Darwin couldn't have conceived is also in its infancy, right? That it's growing us up, and yet we have to grow it up at the same time.
Oh, yeah. And I did another piece. There was a wonderful cover story in National Geographic sometime last year by my friend David Dobbs on the teenage brain. And everything he said about the teenage brain was exactly replicated when you look around the world at the turbulent nature of how we're
Using information right now. Right.
And one thing that was fascinating was he said that, and I hadn't really dug into the neurobiology of the brain as much as he did in this piece, but he said that essentially the transition from teenage brain to adult brain involves a lot of not just new wiring, but rewiring. Things are kind of being unmade and remade. All these connections in the brain are fundamentally going through transformations. And of course, that's reflected in behavior in all kinds of turbulence. So I look at You look at anything from stock markets to commodity prices to the way the Tahrir Square events unfolded and then kind of refolded and kind of modulated themselves through Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah.
To me, it's as if we're test driving new wiring, and we definitely have not figured out how it's all going to work. And then as a blogger, you know, I live in this arena that's both hypervelocity and it can flame up a lie instantaneously, but then the reality becomes exposed equally, not quite as instantaneously, but, you know, Wikipedia has proved, I think I saw a study that there are more Wikipedia entries now are on a par with Encyclopedia Britannica entries in terms of their reliability, if not greater. And that's all part of, you know, the upside of all of this for me is that we're evolving the capacity to collaborate constructively, and as I say, you know, this could also it can work in two directions, but
right, and so if we kind of take this fossil analogy, this world that Teilhard lived in, I mean, the way you see it, if we think about this noosphere, this planetary mind, the internet is really, where'd you say somewhere, one cable and computer at a time. This is kind of the skeleton of this building infrastructure of this noosphere.
Yeah, and this leads to some interesting questions. You know, the Kurzweils of the world have talked about the singularity when they kind of see the potential for this system to essentially become more powerful than we are, but I think it's actually what's much more powerful right now is underway is this growing capacity for this system to help us collaboratively create things and collaboratively feel things and experience things as well in ways that weren't possible before. So it's actually the system that we're building, and this is what Tim O'Reilly and others have called global brain, this kind of capacity to share and shape ideas that's just it's mind-boggling. It's not just a function of computing power. It's mm-hmm. There's something else that's going on. And actually, by the way, this leads me to some interesting thoughts related to stress. Hmm. That we're, you know, the stress we all feel in trying to balance our online lives with our our real lives.
Yeah, and also I think the rapid pace of change so that you never quite feel like you're on top of the technology.
Yeah, I mean, if you were a science fiction writer and you could look at this as if we're now in a struggle between our individual brains mm-hmm. and how much time we should devote to advancing our species through this collective connected system. It's like the difference between being a neuron and being a brain. You see, we all want to be a brain. We have this sense of all of our validation, our identity comes through being an individual, but now there's something right. tugging at us saying, hey, yeah, but we know you can solve bigger problems, maybe like global warming or whatever, through this collaborative process. So you're kind of torn between wanting to be an individual and thinking of yourself more as like just a cog in a bigger machine, a bigger device.
But I think that the way, you know, that the way Teilhard conceived this idea of the noosphere was very much along those lines, right? That in fact, there's something like spiritual evolution of individuals and of humanity as a species. And that, in fact, leads to, he would talk about love, right? I mean, it would lead to the highest, hopefully, would lead to the highest manifestations that human beings are possible. And it would be collaborative. It would be compassionate.
Yeah, and this relates to Thomas Berry is another person who was involved in this kind of thinking, and he talked about the enthrallment that comes through recognizing the human role in making the universe, giving awareness to the universe. Essentially, we're sort of the awareness component of the universe, at least our part of it, and that's part of the universe story is there too, which is in another thread that's interesting.
Right, and it's this leap from mind and knowledge to consciousness, right? Which is a leap that we're still kind of trying to figure out what that means. I mean, I want to ask you about this term. So Teilhard's, the word he coined was noosphere, N-O-O-S, mm-hmm. from the Greek for mind. And you have taken that up and are calling it the noosphere, K-N-O-W-O-sphere.
Sure.
and I'm just wondering if, did you start making this kind of observation you're making and then discover this word for describing it? Or did the word itself help clarify what you were seeing and thinking?
Oh, I guess the first time I mentioned it in print was back in 2002 mm-hmm. when we did a special report for the Science Times section that I came up with about managing planet Earth. And the lead piece had, again, this is when I sort of came through the Vernadsky portal to the word. And it seemed so obvious to me after having spent all this time, you know, the first 20 years of my writing about sustainability issues, climate and biodiversity, I was writing about a biogeophysical system. And then came this aha moment more recently where I started writing more about the behavioral sciences and, you know, how we recognize environmental problems, what kinds of risks we were bad at recognizing. And I got into this whole body of empirical work, you know, good solid science that showed that if you're not paying attention to the mind part, you could spend your life, whether as a journalist or a scientist, articulating a problem and not have anyone actually engage with that problem. And all of that was happening on one level, even as I was just reading, you know, more of the background on this mm-hmm. idea. And then I just, you know, I just liked the 21st spell, 21st
it
century.
It works so well. I mean, it's spelling. So amazing when you see it, because the noosphere, you know, I think a lot of people knew Teilhard or come to him through his spiritual writings. And I think the noosphere actually just by making that play on the word, I mean, it works so well. I mean, don't really change the meaning, but it gives it a different kind of energy. And well, yeah, go on.
Well, one of the other realities, again, in writing about environmental risk for so long, one of the other tough realities with issues like climate change is that it violates all the norms of the kinds of things that we actually do pay attention to, which are usually near and now. Something that's close by or something that's imminent or actually unfolding in a way that changes your life right now. And so the only way you're going to ever have traction on an issue like reining in greenhouse gases, mm-hmm. where the problem is global, where, you know, a molecule of carbon dioxide coming from a taxi cab in Boston or coming from a power plant in China is the same, is part of adding to this atmospheric burden of heat-trapping gases the same. You're only going to have attraction when you have a true sense of a global community. You know, when you really do integrate that the atmosphere is a shared treasure.
Right, and a very present and visceral sense of that, right?
You're not going to have that unless you have planetary mm-hmm. mind. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's why I pay attention to this stuff.
So just if I ask you, I mean, it's interesting to me because the kinds of examples of the noosphere that you write about, it ranges from design to or that you see or that you talk about others seeing, it ranges from design to technological innovation to economic development to climate. So, I mean, if I just ask you right now to, you know, Andy Revkin looks at the world and here are the components you see of what you call the noosphere. Just give me some examples. Paint me some pictures.
Well, it spills into the arts for sure, because one of my favorite examples is the Johnny Cash Project, which is a group of people, including Aaron Koblin, a guy who's now at Google, one of their kind of masters of data visualization. They took one of Johnny Cash's last songs and they created a group-generated artwork where you, if wherever you are, if you're in Tahiti or Taiwan or Italy or wherever, you can take one frame from this video, music video, and paint on it. And then there's like an assortment of frames, and you, the player, can kind of experience the song in a way unique to you by just sort of selecting different artwork frames going through the 3 or so minutes of the song. And so that's just as exciting to me as kind of collaborative work where a scientist or an engineer, I wrote about an example that was my son, Daniel, who's now getting into the film business, but he really likes to do special effects. And in writing about earthquake risk, I saw this wonderful engineering design a guy at Purdue University had done for safer buildings. So if you're in a developing country and you've got to build a school, you have very limited budget, you have some bricks and cement.
You used the example of Pakistan, didn't you?
And so what he did was he came up with a design where you take the exact same materials that are now being used all around the world to build deadly buildings that will fall down in earthquakes. Mm. And if you just change the configuration slightly, it's fundamentally safer. So I said to my son, hey, Daniel, so the engineer had this stuff, but he didn't have the communication skills to tell that story. And so I asked Daniel to get his After Effects software and take a stab at it. And I did a post where he did an animated video showing, without words, how you could make a safer building using the same materials. And that, to me, says a lot of things. It says, so you have an engineer, an animator, and a communicator, me being the communicator,
right,
doing something together that none of those parties could do alone. And that, again, with the web, that doesn't require the internet. But it's incredibly facilitated by the internet. So
right.
what I push for when I speak and what I'm trying to build at Pace University a little bit is portals like Match.com for skill sets, which again is richer than just sharing information. It's about actually creating new ways to understand something that are just fundamentally easier with this kind of a setup.
Yeah, I mean, here's some language from you again that I feel like if Teilhard could have known that someone would say this in 2012, you know, it would have been thrilling to him. You know, you said whatever term you use, and you were referring back to the noosphere idea. It's clear that the world is quickly being knitted by new ways to share observations and shape ideas that are bound to have impacts on the quality of the human journey. And that is kind of spiritual language. I mean, do you use the word spirituality?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, and this gets back to another ugly reality of issues like climate change, which is they're always cast as scientific. You know, the IPCC says the National Academy of Sciences says that. But when you actually examine rigorously the decision process, you realize you have this immediately, well, it quickly moves from the realm of science into the realm of values.
Yeah.
In other words, how much is too much? How much warming is too much? It's not a science question. The pace of sea level rise, you know, slowing that pace by 10% by doing heroic things with greenhouse gases. There are all these trade-offs. Well, you know, it's going to cost poor people more money to have energies if we shift away from fossil fuels. So how do we weigh the benefits there versus the benefits of slowing sea level rise or, you know, reducing the risk of crop failure? None of those are really scientific questions. They get into the realm of economics and very quickly into the realm of values.
Right. And I mean, I suppose we can get pretty tangled up when we're even just speaking in the realm of fact, but when you start talking about values, it becomes very fraught in another way.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the things that I've also, this is a different word I've proposed in, you know, this era has been increasingly called the Anthropocene, the
yes.
sort of the era of the human managed planet.
Yeah, which is another way of, it's another image, right, isn't it,
but
for what Teilhard was saying?
Yeah, but what I wrote a piece a year or so ago, in fact, I thought about writing a book about this, but I just haven't had time, is that we need to have a little of what I call anthropophilia if we're going to have a smooth ride in the Anthropocene,
right.
Which means we have to get more comfortable with our differences and our natural, within any population, you're going to have people who will have different judgments about the same body of science. And only by having a connectedness so that such that when you go onto the web, you're not staying in your own little bubble, whether it's a green bubble or a libertarian bubble,
yeah.
but willing to reach out to understand other people's views, then that's also part of the noosphere, is sort of finding places where you can get people who have maybe fundamentally different views of a certain energy choice, but might have the same view on energy efficiency. Then you say, oh, there's a place we can work. And that's all part of this too, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, again, that's where I feel like when I read Teilhard de Chardin 100 years ago, I feel like there was something so prescient and ahead of his time. You know, so this is, to me, the way you just talked is a reflection of him saying something like, speaking about how it's important that we focus on the interior as well as the exterior of things, on mind as well as matter. You know, yeah. He said, the true physics is that which will one day achieve the inclusion of man in his wholeness in a coherent picture of the world.
Yeah. All I can say is yeah.
and so, but I see you using terms like, when you talk about, okay, as we've said, it's not inevitable that this technology drives towards this kind of coherence. But you talk about what's important is, you know, you use language like engagement and intentionality.
Right.
And that you're talking about our relationship with our technology, right, and all these things that are becoming possible.
Sure. And I teach a course at Pace University that I launched last year. This is the second year in blogging. And it's really not just a course just in blogging. It's a course in how to get the most out of the internet, how to get the most out of all this connectivity, and whether it's on video or through Twitter or through a blog or all of the above. And one of the things I stress, and I think that I illustrate pretty effectively early on for the students, is that this is all about intentionality. In fact, it's not a course. The course is called Blogging a Better Planet, but I don't define Better Planet. I ask them to take their own passions mm-hmm. and find some little, in other words, there might be a student who's interested in fashion or another in music, which is the case this year,
yeah.
another one in travel. And I say, find the component of the thing that excites you that also fits in this frame of smoothing our journey. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have intentionality, you could go out there and just sell widgets. It's really, yeah. the internet's really good at selling widgets. Twitter with these, I wrote a piece a couple of years ago about the rise of what are called promoted trends,
yeah,
promoted
right,
trend.
Right. Yeah,
you know, this can all be usurped and
right as evil, right as
yeah,
the Twitter version of evil.
and as I say, you know, the internet helped the 9/11 organizers learn where to find their flight schools and stuff. So it can work in terrible ways as well. But I see the upside swamping the downside, especially if young people early on are trained. Not trained, but learn on their own how this can work for betterment.
I also feel like something you are naming that I'm really aware of, but I don't feel like it gets the publicity that it should, is the connection between, you know, the web and human community and the kind of very interesting paradox that... you know, of course, you can talk about how the online world and our online lives are alienating us from each other, and that's true. But it's also true that in many ways, online engagement drives people to a new kind of hunger for human connection, and then regrouping in a new way in community.
I think that's true, and you know, in that sense, I do think it can work to push you back into the real world. And I think, of course, ultimately what we're building, or what can be facilitated, again, by through purposeful action, is to build kind of a hub and spoke system where you have, you know, real campuses with human beings doing stuff or businesses connected through the efficiency and immediacy of the internet to other places, so you can share your experiences where you get this kind of hybrid experience. In fact, I did a post, I think, about hybrid experience with nature, you know, and this is a fun thing. When I give my talks these days, I show this little video clip that my younger son, he and I a few years ago went rowing into an area in suburban Florida near where my parents lived. There was a little kind of a mangrove patch in the middle of suburbia, and we went rowing up in there, and he had the video camera and shot a little documentary at the age of 9 of heron babies. These little, he found them deep in the bushes, and you know, it was an incredibly valuable experience for him to have. But by recording it and then posting it on YouTube, he had a durable experience, and the sharing of that information, which is a primordial thing. Remember, human beings, whether it's around the campfire or at the bedside, you know, we just love to say what we experience. And so for him, he has a richer way to handle that experience of having come upon and sort of discovered these hatchling herons, but having had the hybrid experience of sharing that through the internet, I think it's much more durable for him as a result.
Yeah, and that's interesting too. It's an example of how we don't just share knowledge, that we can share experience in a new way.
Yeah, and that's why noosphere is not perfect, because it kind of implies this is all about knowledge.
It's mental, yeah.
And it's not. By the way, the other body of work that I love is Dan Siegel, who you met. For all I know, you've had him on the program before.
I haven't, but I do know his work. But go on.
Well,
yeah.
He's a UCLA psychiatrist who he's done a lot of work on the value of meditation. And I've met him here in Garrison, where I live, because the Garrison Institute has held these meetings on climate, mind, and behavior. And he's come and given talks about how the human mind, we think of as, you know, encased in our cranium, but his definition of mind extends out into the world outside, the world of your relationships with other people. And he talks about us having a we map and a me map. And he's done work that illustrates pretty rigorously that some of us have bigger we maps and smaller me maps. And this also syncs up with some wonderful work at Yale by the cultural cognition group there, led by Dan Kahane, who talks about the normal range among us of from communitarians to individualists, and which is basically, you know, the we map me map stuff. In other words, a liberal is someone who wants to have a basically socialized healthcare. You know, so
right.
we're all in this together, and the me map person is more of we need our liberty to do the things we can do that will make the world a better place.
So mind is too small a word, and it's a diversity of
yeah, but you see the
mind.
Noosphere, yes. this network can expand our we maps.
Yeah.
So I think it's making us more we-ish, so to speak.
And you know, I think when you talk about including experience and not just in knowledge or even bringing the idea of meditation into it. So, I mean, I think the way Teilhard, you know, there was that whole spiritual theological piece for him, which encompassed all of that. I mean, encompassed it in different forms, but that's, I mean, he brought all of that together in the kind of fullness of his person.
I think it's true. And, you know, again, whether it's interviews I've had with Pete Seeger, the great folk singer who
you know,
also lives
I just
nearby.
Saw that you perform with him.
Knock on wood, yeah. I have had that luck a number of times, many times.
Yeah, it's so exciting.
But I've also interviewed him about this stuff, and he said some wonderful things. I put them on my SoundCloud page at one point. He said scientists have sometimes too high a view of themselves, in the sense that, as I said earlier, you know, there's this presumption that science tells you what to do and that science is value-free. But there's been more and more work that holds up Pete's notion that science is full of values-based orientations as well. And that that we need to get comfortable with the reality that faith and is a normal part of how we experience the world and make decisions.
And I mean, I feel like a lot of scientists are even getting more comfortable, maybe even with the language of soul and spirit, if they're not religious, and certainly are comfortable with the language of mystery. And I mean, I see that happening too. Sometimes it's just a matter of getting the language right, starting the discussion in the right place.
The place where that tends to break down is when science becomes what they call policy relevant. In other words, whether it's stem cells or global warming, that's when it's harder for scientists to keep track of their own, what's a values feeling in their own reaction to information or reaction to someone's debating the science versus where the data are.
So, you know, I was going to ask you... I mean, I think we've been kind of moving, pointing at this, you know, so you talk about your students and as you interact with them, as you bring this idea of the noosphere to different groups of people, very different groups of people. I'm just wondering how you see, again, this idea, which was, you know, very, not exclusively, but very, very much formed by this Jesuit paleontologist 100 years ago, Teilhard de Chardin. You know, how is that received by modern people? And also, how are modern people adding to that, qualifying, expanding it?
In some ways, you know, I wasn't around 100 years ago, so I know that it was obviously resisted at the time. So I would say it's more accessible and probably getting a better response now than it would have in his own era.
Yeah.
In the sense that I think people can get it with a capital G a lot easier now, the sense that you can have a planetary intelligence. There's a big group at MIT, one of the most hard-nosed institutions around. The Center for Collective Intelligence is all about this very question of what can we do better as a result of all these connections than we could before. They're approaching this as from the research vantage point, but also from the idea they have a collab on climate, where they're trying to experiment with ways to design web-based tools that can actually foster better outcomes for climate diplomacy, climate policy, that kind of thing. My dogs are barking.
I know. It's okay, isn't it, Chris? It's okay. Well, you know, it's a real world interview.
Sure.
Yeah, I want to finish, but where was my mind? You know, I think one way people had been skeptical of him, I mean, you're right in saying that it was hard. These were very radical ideas, and of course, he wasn't able to publish until after his ideas weren't published until after his death. Mm-hmm. But he was a real. I think one thing I've heard, criticism I hear is skeptical people, maybe in the 20th century certainly, felt that he was too much of an optimist, that his vision was too hopeful, and that it presupposed too much goodness on the part of human beings. I think it's so interesting to hear the way you talk about the fact that the way this technology is shaping up and our use of it, it actually doesn't just come down to our goodness, right? You're talking about it, the technology these structures and networks as they form become kind of self-correcting because there's this mass of human mind involved.
Yeah, well, going forward, I share his optimism overall. I think our potential for good as a species has always dominated the potential for bad in the end. And this just amplifies those same tendencies. None of the issues that we face on the internet are unique to the internet. They're all...
What do you mean by that?
Well, they're all part of who we are. In a crowded room, the loudest, angriest people, whatever their ideology, tend to get the most airtime.
Yeah.
So one thing I try to do on my blog is try to build tools to foster some input from the quieter people.
Yeah.
And there's another book that's relevant here by David Weinberger, professor who studies internet and society at Harvard, in which he talks about the need to build what he calls smart rooms. The subtitle of his book is that the room is smarter than everybody in it now. which is this. But you still need to build smartness in there. You still need to build a space where you can end up with more constructive discourse than noise.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the turbulent adolescent nature, as we spoke of at the beginning. You know, this is a new system. We're as I've said before, another metaphor that comes to mind is it's as if we've been plunked at the wheel of a speeding car, but we haven't taken driver's training, and there isn't even a driver's manual for the car because. And we're rounding a corner and the weather's foggy and we're accelerating. and in a moment like that, you can either be hopeful or woeful, but it almost doesn't matter in the end. So we're test driving a new system here. Mm-hmm. If turbulence is normal, and experiments in communication will fail as much or more than they will succeed. But, I think our overall, nature, to my mind, and it's an act of faith on my part, as it was on his part, we'll swamp the downside.
On Teilhard's part, yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's great. I think that's good. I do want to say, you know, that's how I think about I think about creating a hospitable media space, right? It's like creating these new kinds of spaces where something different can happen. Well, I love talking to you. I love reading you, and... We will let you know what's great. Happening with this. I think we're going to be producing it in the next couple weeks. And no. Do you know David Sloan Wilson, evolutionary biologist? You'd probably be interested in him. I mean, he's an evolutionary biologist. He wrote something called Darwin's Cathedral. He's not religious, but he's analyzed religions as successful groups, successfully evolutionary groups. And he's actually applying the best insights of evolutionary biology, the positive insights, to real world problems like how do you he's working on this project to revitalize Binghamton, New York, and he has a chapter in this book he wrote on the Binghamton Neighborhood Project, which is called Welcome to the Noosphere. So he's going to be in the show as well. Fabulous. And a Teilhard biographer, and thank you so much, and we'll stay in touch.
Help promote the heck out of it, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great. Thank you. And what did you say,
pass
Dave?
The phone to Karen.
Oh, okay.
Thank you
again for your time. Could you pass the phone to Karen?
Good to talk with you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Karen.